Bonjour. Welcome to So French, the show about the twists and turns, intrigues and insights to all things French.
Every 2 weeks, we select the best, most interesting and fascinating of French news stories, all brought to you from our studio in the heart of Paris. This week, Sarah is traveling, so I'm joined by Julia Vier. We will hear more of you the next couple of episodes. Bienvenue, Julia. And my name is Stefan de Vries.
At the end of next month, Europe will go to the polls to elect a new European Parliament. We will talk to Europeans living in Paris about how they see life on the continent.
We will talk about fake news with a special guest, Jackson Webster. He's a cybersecurity consultant in Paris, and we will talk with him about fighting fake news.
And Emmanuel Macron appointed 3 new ministers this week. We will tell you who they are.
But first, just when you thought it wasn't possible, Paris property prices have risen even further. And it's now almost surpassing the €10,000 per square meter barrier. So even in the most shabby neighborhoods, you have to pay over €10,000 for a tiny apartment. And in the more chic neighborhoods, you pay almost €15,000. So that's a lot of money. And it's about an 8% increase compared to last year's prices. And over the past 10 years, houses in Paris became 62.5% more expensive. So Julia, it's almost impossible to buy an apartment or a house in Paris. Is renting then maybe a solution?
Well, renting is actually not a cheap solution either. Real estate agent Lock Service brought out a report this week, and they said that a 31 square meter studio in the capital is now officially higher than €1,000. And that's double the average rental price outside of the Paris region.
Wow, okay. And what's the chicest or the most expensive area in Paris?
Well, that would be the 6th arrondissement around Odeon. And the cheapest is the 19th around La Chapelle.
Yeah, that's in the north of the city. And Odeon is, of course, in the heart of the city. Very nice neighborhood indeed. And what you see is that people who used to live in the center now go more away from the center because it's less expensive. But then they, well, make it more expensive, of course. And that's, you know, every time people go further away from the city center, and it becomes more and more expensive even around the city. So yeah, that's almost a ripple effect, of course. Why is it so expensive in Paris? I mean, of course, Paris is very attractive and world famous and many museums, but it seems much more expensive than other European cities.
Well, many people also blame the shortage of new housing being built, actually, in Paris. And some also blame the Brexit, because rich people look for alternatives to London. And a while ago, there was the most expensive Parisian apartment was sold for €39 million, also by an industrial tycoon who wanted to leave the UK because of the Brexit uncertainty.
So Brexit is to blame. Now, you are originally from Amsterdam. Is Paris an exception, or is housing also very expensive there? And what about other European capitals?
Well, in Amsterdam, it's also the case that prices get higher and higher. But it's still comparatively cheap. Well, I wouldn't say cheap, but to Paris, because it's around 6,000. And that's about the same as in Stockholm and Vienna, which are also two popular cities in Europe, of course. And it does get more and more difficult in Amsterdam to find something, especially as a student.
So yeah, Paris, Amsterdam, Stockholm, very expensive. But so where should you go if you have no money? What are the cheapest cities in Europe?
Well, Warsaw is pretty cheap, and so is Budapest in Hungary. There it is about €2,000 per square meter. But the most affordable capital is Sofia, capital of Bulgaria, where it is only €1,000 per square meter. So that means you can buy a 100 square meter apartment for the same price as a 9 square meter studio in Paris.
Wow, that's a huge difference. Well, so if you have some money to spare, either invest it in Paris if you have a lot of money, and if not, you have to go to Sofia, also a nice city. It's not Paris exactly, but nevertheless. And let's see, ever-rising housing prices in Paris. Now, Now it's time for a special section of our show. So fake. There was a lot of fake news this week, or at least a lot of happened this week in the fake news arena. Like, for instance, that police has tried to fight fake news circulating on social media about attempted kidnappings by Roma people, and they led to real-life violence, these rumors and fake news. On Facebook, Twitter and Snapchat, false rumors were being spread about Roma trying to abduct children in white vans.
Yeah, and they even led a group of people with knives and sticks to attack a Roma encampment in the Parisian suburb of Bobigny. The police has arrested 20 people and has tried to combat the false reports on social media itself. And in at least six other suburbs, Roma have also been chased or attacked. And yes, it's weird since at least 2010 an online hoax has circulated in France about a white van allegedly used in kidnappings.
Yeah, but there are no white vans. It's just not true.
Yeah, it's weird. But yeah, but people believe it because actually the social media posts also use pictures even, which create more impact, of course.
Yeah, so pictures of white vans, but it's just random vans.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Very strange story, but it's very serious because it led to a lot of violence this week. And even though the police said it's all not true, they still have to protect the Roma, right?
Yeah, and they even called for all-round protection as well by the police. To discuss all that, we have a special guest this week. It's Jackson Webster. You're an expert in cybersecurity based in Paris, and you work at Legal Cluster, which is a legal startup in Paris.
Yeah, welcome, Jackson. Now, Jackson, how come people seem to believe everything they read online, even to such an extent that they turn to real violence and even act on these rumors?
I don't think that everyone necessarily believes everything they read on the internet. I think it's an issue of what sources are trusted and what sources are not. And I mean, the issue with especially a platform, you know, the platforms that are growing right now, Snapchat, WhatsApp, etc., is that these are places where the stuff you're going to be receiving is going to be from friends or friends of friends or neighbors or people in your community. You know, it's the same kind of basic trust model that local journalism used to rely upon, you know, before the market was essentially captured by these social media platforms. And so there's, you know, an issue of, you know, do I believe this piece of, you know, what is ultimately fake news that was shared by, you know, let's say, you know, my neighbor or my neighbor's friend or whatever, or do I believe the report from some random government official or from, you know, some prefecture somewhere or from a national newspaper, you know, who I might think is out of touch with my community, right? That's essentially the problem that we're running into here.
Yeah. Now, French lawmakers, they proposed an anti-fake news law. They want now to change that proposition already to ensure that posts like these are quickly removed. How hard is it to regulate hate speech or even, well, in this case, it's fake news. How hard it is to regulate it?
I personally, I mean, this might just be a sort of American opinion because of the First Amendment sort of course, mentality, yeah. But personally, I don't buy the regulate away the fake news. I mean, for one, if we're really going to talk about the spread of disinformation, I mean, this is not a new phenomenon. No. It's just, you know, like all things that have been happening on social media, it's an issue of scale, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, for example, you know, bullying wasn't something that was created by Facebook, but, you know, online bullying is all of a sudden so much easier with...
Yeah.
With social media platforms and with the platformization of pretty much everything, so for me the legislative approach is problematic because in the end if you're going to pass a law, you know, it's all well and good to say, oh, let's pass a law to, you know, ban fake news that might incite violence or etc., but at the same time that also involves sort of implicit questions such as, you know, what is fake news, right? Because there can also be news that is an opinion which you might believe is an incorrect opinion, but which is based, you know, ultimately on fact. And
yeah.
There is room for legitimate political disagreement on the definition of what fake news means, and what disinformation means, and even what hate speech means, right? And so I think those are some of the sort of boundaries of that approach that you're running up against when you're trying to legislate this away.
Yeah, it's a good point, because this week actually the French government seemed to have spread, or at least Macron, fake news himself, using an anonymous account, Pierre Le Texier. He's from Macron's e-influence division. So there's already inside the government there's a division that's trying to influence people. He distributed a tweet with two videos, and they were actually about the famous Benalla affair. It was actually a made-up video retrieved from the police illegally. So this shows that even the government themselves, they are using... Well, or trying to manipulate the truth. So,
well, at the same time, in the United States, I mean, President Donald Trump regularly refers to reports that he doesn't like as fake news. And yeah. I mean, this is a constant trope of authoritarian figures around the world. In the same way that after the attempted coup d'etat in Turkey in 2016, I mean, you know, Erdogan went around and shut down pretty much all of the independent newspapers. The government basically bought them out and then shut them down. Again, the issue with giving, you know, making the government the ultimate arbiter of what is and isn't, you know, fake news in the end, is that this term can be weaponized fairly easily, in the same way that, for example, terrorism, you know, can be weaponized, in the same way that that internal security actors in Europe and the United States might legitimately, you know, use this term to refer to people that they're, you know, who violent attacks they're trying to stop, which ultimately is a good thing for security. At the same time, you know, the Ukrainian government has often been accused of stretching the term and sort of referring to, you know, the anti-terrorist operation, right, as their military operation in the eastern part of the country. And
so governments can use the argument of fake news actually against spreading real news.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, again, if we retake the term, you know, the term fake news, they can often be used in the same way that the term terrorism can be used, or terrorist can be used to sort of delegitimize any actor that might be opposing the state. I mean, this is the classic language of state security. I mean, and the sort of extreme example would be the Assad government in Syria, which has described not only the legitimately labeled by the UN terrorist organizations opposing the government as terrorists, but has also labeled, you know, the Free Syrian Army and the Kurds as well as quote unquote terrorists. And we can take this to any number of examples. I mean, with, for example, the Russians and the Chechens in 2004, or, you know, and that labels like this can be dangerous if ill-defined, because there leaves room for political exploitation.
Yeah, and then the question of who defines these rules, well, in general, it will be the government. Now, France has a lot of laws against the freedom of expression, or that actually limit the freedom of expression and freedom of opinion. But it seems that the French, they are fine with that. You know, even this new fake news law, there was not a lot of debate about it. Do you think the French are maybe less free, or they don't attach the same value to the freedom of expression as other European countries? Or
I think there's sort of three answers there. The first one is the obvious historical legacy of where that limitation on speech comes from, which is a post-World War II reaction to anti-Semitism, which obviously is a particular historical heritage that other countries like the United States, for example, don't necessarily have. But sort of on the other hand, I think that in general, there is a natural response within French politics that whenever there is an issue, it is the responsibility of the state to legislate it away. That's essentially the reflexive reaction of the political system here. And then, you know, sort of onto the third point, I think that, you know, there's a saying about the French, you know, that they demand many, many rules for their society and also demand the right to break them occasionally. And it is, you know, this kind of bizarre tension between being, you know, both sort of a Mediterranean, you know, quote unquote Latin civilization, but in Northern Europe. And I think that manifests itself in exactly this discussion where, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say that France is particularly restrained in terms of how people express themselves here any more than anywhere else in Europe would be, but more that there is that sort of baseline reaction that, oh, there's a security problem, or oh, there's a social problem.
Let's make a law.
Exactly. That's the immediate reflex.
Now, the interesting thing this week was that the French government was also an advertiser this week, or they wanted to be an advertiser. They wanted to publish a campaign for the European elections on Google and Facebook. But Google and Facebook took the new law literally. And they just said, no, we don't want this advertisement because it's a political campaign and it's fake news. Now, do you think that Twitter and Facebook and the other platforms take the French new law too literally, or are they just afraid to make any mistakes? Because the French government says, yeah, our campaign is just about elections. It's not political campaigning, but they fell more or less into their own sword.
Twitter, I think, is not really as interesting of an example here. I think that Facebook is quite a good example to prove this, you know, to discuss the sort of like phenomenon that we're seeing here. I mean, look, Facebook relies very heavily on its relationships with various governments around the world. And has a very deep relationship with the French government on anti-radicalization issues and other very sensitive topics here. And also, you know, needs to maintain a very, you know, needs to toe the line from a regulatory standpoint, right? Because they, you know, Facebook is well aware of the fact that it is not exactly in the good graces of regulators around the world right now, particularly in Brussels and in Washington and in California, to a lesser extent. And that therefore, you know, I think that there is sort of an extra amount of caution that's being exercised, but that also they don't want to be seen as being, you know, complicit in some sort of governmental action or explicitly political action from like a public relations standpoint with their users as well.
Yeah. Do you think now we're about a month and a half before the European elections, fake news, the issue of fake news is a real issue in the campaign. And do you think it's a real threat to security or to democracy? Or do we take it maybe, do we give it too much credit?
In terms of the European elections, I think the obvious threat is low voter turnout, and that's always been the problem for European elections, particularly in certain countries, namely France and other parts of sort of Western Europe, including the United Kingdom. And so in the end, I think the real issue is more that when you have a misrepresentation of a misrepresentation at the European level of people's actual opinions, because the only ones who go out and vote are the ones who are particularly fired up in one direction or another. And so, you know, the sort of average beliefs of the average person are not going to get represented in the parliament, and that leads to its own sort of political delegitimization. I think for me, that's a much more important problem than fake news in the European election is, you know, the lack of news. I think no one follows it. And so it's much easier to have, you know, a problem of fake news in something like an American presidential election, which everyone, you know, not just around the country, but around the world falls very closely. And then, you know, in a European parliamentary election, it's a little bit less important, in some ways. I mean, but there are attempts to fight this. I mean, the EU has its, you know, EU Against Disinformation, you know, which does the same kind of work that Radio Free Europe has been doing in Eastern Europe for a long time. And then, of course, you have a initiative by, I think it was Libération and some other European newspapers in Germany, Netherlands, and other countries that have teamed up for, it's Fact Check EU is the name of the initiative. I heard about it at a conference recently, and that basically the idea is that you're going to have like a fact-checking organization for, you know, for the European elections. The issue, of course, is that when we're talking about the volume of information that's shared on social media platforms, it's extremely difficult to be, you know, because AI can only help you out so much. AI can help you identify jihadi videos or inappropriate visual content, but it's particularly bad at identifying, for example, false information and stuff. So you really need human moderators. And so then, of course, you're constrained by how many people can you hire to do this and how fast can they do it? And I mean, before the German elections, in Germany, there was a fact-checking organization. I can't remember who was sponsoring it or not, but from what I understood, they were only able to mobilize their people to verify about 100 claims in the couple of weeks running up to the election, which is fine if we're talking about, you know, for example, a foreign influence operation using traditional media, right? So like a Sputnik, you know, newspaper type thing. But if we're talking about false information spread organically or by bots on Twitter, I mean, this is just the flow of information is so large that it's almost impossible to to get the human labor power there to adequate to to address it.
And then, of course, the question is, who's going to check the checkers?
Of course, yes. And I mean, I don't know if you were able to read the Verge article on the Facebook content moderators that came out last month, I believe. It was very interesting. And talking about how the quality assurance model with these contract content moderators was that you had, people paid sort of living wage who are moderating content. And then there's a QA specialist who's paid $1 an hour more than them. And that's essentially their hierarchy model, right? And that those are then the people who are making the decisions as to the quote unquote accuracy of the moderation, right? And the problem though is when you're moderating hundreds, if not thousands of posts a day, I mean, as an individual at a certain point, there is some kind of error that's going to factor in there. And these are subjective decisions. These are not objective decisions. I mean, it's very difficult to sort of distinguish between legitimate political discourse and what could be considered xenophobia because, believing, for example, that there should be this or that type of limit on a certain kind of immigration is not necessarily a white nationalist opinion, but then
actually in the programs of most political parties nowadays.
It usually, and it has been for a long time, and so it's very difficult to sort of draw that line at scale, right? Yeah. Not with individual arguments, but at scale to draw that line between, where does it cross over from, legitimate political discourse into something that might actually be, dangerous and discriminatory.
But it's still on Emmanuel Macron's radar, one of his most important points in his election campaign towards the European elections. Thank you very much, Jackson Webster. Your Twitter account is @JOliverWebster.
Yes.
And you're a security expert. Working at Legal Cluster in Paris. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Vous écoutez So French.
You are listening to So French.
Also this week, French President Emmanuel Macron has appointed 3 new ministers in an expected cabinet reshuffle, including the minister who will be in charge of handling Brexit-related issues.
Yeah, and that in the week that Brexit became even more complicated. And the reason he did so was that the 3 ministers who are being replaced decided to go on a campaign. The first minister, Nathalie Loiseau, was the Minister of European Affairs. She is now the leader of the list for the European elections of the party of Emmanuel Macron. She will be replaced by Amélie de Montchalin. She becomes the junior minister for European Affairs. She was already in Macron's party as a member of parliament. She comes at a very critical moment, of course, because she will also have to deal with Brexit and post-Brexit Europe. So a pretty difficult program for Amélie de Montchalin.
And apparently she doesn't have a cat that is named Brexit. Was only a
indeed.
Rumor.
Nathalie Loiseau was making jokes about that. Then the second person, also a woman, is Sibit Ndia. She was Macron's communications advisor. She was pretty controversial because she once said that she wouldn't have no problems lying for the president. She is now the spokeswoman of the government, so she will have to face the press every week. And then there is Cédric Oh, which is a very short last name. He's the new junior minister for digital affairs. He's replacing Mounir Majoubi. He also resigned last week because he wants to run for Paris mayor in 2020. And all the 3 new ministers are younger than 40. So Macron is still continuing rejuvenating French politics. But they come, of course, at a crucial moment. Macron already has lost quite a few ministers since he became president just 2 years ago. Actually, 10 of them already have quit in only 2 years. So it's about 1 every 2 months. Pretty
yeah,
unstable.
And it's a record at this stage of a presidential term.
Oh, is it? Okay, I didn't know that. But yeah, there's a lot of people he lost. Some of them wanted to do something else. Others were not convinced about the president's agenda. And these 3 who resigned this week, well, they want to do something else. They want to become either a member of the European Parliament or even the mayor of Paris. So that's a reshuffle this week in the cabinet, in the government of Emmanuel Macron. Now, in a little over 2 months, Europeans are taking to the polls for the European elections. They will take place from the 23rd of May till the 26th of May. In France, you can vote on Sunday, the 26th of May, also if you're a European citizen living in France. So we decided to have a look how Europeans living in Paris think about Europe.
Yeah, so each episode I will ask an expat in France about their European citizenship and what it means for them. This week I met with Eva from Spain on the Boulevard de Belleville, which is close to where she lives.
My name is Eva. I'm Spanish and I live in France. I've been living in France for 3.5 years now.
Do you consider yourself a European citizen?
Well, I was born when Spain was already belonged to the European Union, so I haven't even really asked myself that question. Of course, I'm Spanish before everything else, but yes, I'm European as well.
And do you plan on staying here?
For the moment, yes. I don't think I'll stay in Paris all my life. But now Paris feels like home.
And if you will vote for the European elections, will you vote in Spain or in France?
In France, because I live here. I have not been reading much on the European election, but I guess I will be voting for the Green parties.
What do you think it means to be a European in France?
Well, for me, I think it's actually in France where I've come to understand what being a European is, actually, because I work with people from all over the world. I'm very lucky, and I see how it's difficult for them to get their visas and to get freedom of movement in the European Union. And that's when I understood that it was easy for me because I'm European. So being European in France is kind of relief. Like, I feel I'm privileged.
Well, that wraps up this edition of So French. We hope you have enjoyed it. Please follow us on Twitter. And also on Instagram, our account is at So French News. We will put exclusive content made by Julia on Instagram. So please follow us there. And if you would like to contact us, please mail us on news@sofrench.news.
And don't forget to rate us on iTunes and please leave a review so that more people will find us. And if you are in Paris, you can also listen to us on air on World Radio Paris, the only English language radio station in Paris.
And if you like French music, check out our free playlist on Spotify, which we update regularly. Just search for So French Music or click the link on our website.
We'll be back in 2 weeks with a new episode of So French.
We hope you'll join us then. Thanks for listening.
Au revoir.